Hey, hi! Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and I'm mostly over my cold. My guest this week is Ian McIntyre, a writer and story editor whose credits include Degrassi, Next Class, and recent seasons of the Inspector Gadget and George of the Jungle animated series. He also writes for the Beaverton Online, which my Canadian listeners may feel is especially relevant of late. Ian picked Ghostbusters, Ivan Reitman's 1984 effects comedy starring Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, and Harold Ramis, as parapsychologists who get kicked out of Columbia, reinvent themselves as supernatural exterminators, and wind up saving the world from extra-dimensional destruction. As you do. A high-concept comedy with a perfect cast and a maddeningly catchy theme song, it became the year's biggest hit, earning nearly $230 million at the domestic box office and landing Oscar nominations for Best Visual Effects and Best Original Song. And it's a total coincidence that we're following up last week's Aliens episode with another Sigourney Weaver 80s classic, but what can I say? Sometimes everything just lines up. This is someone else's movie.
I've loved this movie ever since I was a kid, but I just got to be a weirdly big fan of it in the last handful of years.
Mm-hmm.
But even still, the guys who are freaking out about it nowadays, about the new one, I can't grasp that.
Yeah, it's good that we can get this out of the way up top.
Yes.
But it's insane. Like, it really is insane. People are, as with Gamergate, people are going out of their way to insist that it's not about the thing that it's about.
Yeah, exactly.
So transparently
about the thing that it's about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just, and don't get me wrong, I understand that people out there don't like reboots. I didn't see online petitions about Total Recall last year, or RoboCop, or any other number of beloved 80s movies that are being remade.
Yeah, and in those cases, projects that actually should have maybe been prevented.
Yes, someone should have stopped them. But, yeah, I don't know. Just watching this is just, ugh. Yeah.
Yeah. There's no, it's the slipperiness, right? It's the fact that they can't. I'm trying to figure out just how many of the people who are most volubly opposed to a female-led remake of Ghostbusters understand that it's, someone on Twitter pointed it out beautifully a couple of weeks ago. They said that basically they're arguing that this movie is no longer for me because it doesn't represent me, because I don't see dudes.
Yes.
Because I cannot see myself. I can't imagine myself, which is so bizarre, right? Because, you know, if you go to the Ebert theory of movies as an empathy machine, that you're supposed to be able to imagine what it would be like to be a woman fighting ghosts as easily as a guy fighting ghosts. And it's not like the first film uses, I mean, they're wonderful actors, but those characters are kind of fuck-ups, and that's the point of Ghostbusters, which is that these are dangerously unqualified people running around New York with nuclear technology fighting spirits. And then I have no problem with women doing the same thing because it makes it different and interesting-er.
Yeah, I mean, Ghostbusters at its heart was an underdog story when they made it back in the day. You know, it's sort of that 80s slobs versus snobs kind of idea.
Yeah, it's kind of the last gasp of it, really.
Well, it's like the last tail end of like Meatballs, Caddyshack, that kind of idea, and Animal House. But it's I don't know. Nowadays, if you want to have that same kind of story of people not taking these Ghostbusters seriously, I think it makes sense to make them women.
Mm-hmm.
The incredulity that they are going to have at not being taken seriously. Although I definitely think the comedic engine of this movie is going to be different.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Paul Feig just does a different sense of humor. Everyone in it does a very different sense of humor. The one interesting thing about the original movie is, as much as they are all fuck-ups, they are very rarely seen. They're very rarely comedically low status in it. They're always the smartest guys in the room. And it's very rarely that the rug gets pulled out from under them, like with the exception of Bill Murray getting slime on him or something like that.
Right.
And I definitely get the impression from the trailers that this new movie, like, Kristen Wiig is going to play low status a lot. And that'll be like the comedic thing, which is fine, because that's just her comedic hit a lot of the time.
Yeah, and it's her wheelhouse.
It's her wheelhouse. Yeah, exactly. If anything, I get the impression that Kate McKinnon is going to be the closest to what Bill Murray was doing in that first movie, which is, like, at every moment, Bill Murray is kind of, like, making, or rather, his character, Venkman, is, like, making jokes for himself.
Yeah.
Kind of at the expense of everyone around him and kind of just to amuse himself, and he doesn't really care if anyone notices.
Yeah, it's a really weird trait that I don't remember noticing the first time around. Like, when I was a kid, I saw Ghostbusters in 1984, I think on its opening day.
Holy smokes.
I'm old.
I'm jealous.
I would have been 15. It was the old York Theater on Young and Eglinton in this giant room, and it was 70 millimeter. It was like that back in the day when the event movie was whatever the studios were releasing that week.
Oh, that sounds so good.
And it was a lot of fun. And it's going to read Dexter. It's not you. It's him. He knows better. He doesn't know anything. But it played. It played beautifully. And I don't think there was time to appreciate all of the bits, all of the elements, all of the really idiosyncratic construction. Because for a major motion picture studio event, which is definitely how it was pitched at the time, it's insanely... idiosyncratic doesn't even begin to cover
it. It's a movie that should not have worked even close to as well that it worked. Like, have you heard about how fast they made it?
Yeah.
They pitched it, like, I think May of 1983... No, he pitched it in fall of... pitched in May of 1983. They started shooting in fall of 1983 to deliver it summer of 1984.
Yeah, June, I think it was the 8th. Same day Gremlins opened, which was even weirder.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What some a great weekend.
Yeah, I saw Gremlins in the afternoon and Ghostbusters in the evening.
Oh, goddamn. That sounds amazing.
Well, they were right across the road from each other, practically.
Ah, you're killing me.
This was the glory days of Toronto, when there were giant theaters in every neighborhood.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, no, it was a good day.
Yeah, no, that sounds amazing. But yeah, like, just how much of that movie is, like, the script was half-finished, and the bits were getting improvised on the fly, and, like, even the whole Cross the Streams thing was something that Ramis threw in halfway through shooting, because they were like, oh, shit, we need a way to end this movie. It's not the tightest constructed plot ever made.
No, I mean, it kind of has one.
It has as much of one as it needs.
Yeah, it really doesn't care.
No. I mean,
ultimately, it's alternately a really creepy pickup artist comedy, because the scenes with, and I've mentioned this on the podcast once or twice before, because it's one of those amazing examples of watching it 30 years later and realizing that Bill Murray's character, like Peter Venkman, is essentially, he's not just hitting on
Sarah's
character, he's aggressively pushing himself up against her and cornering her and flirting with her, and it still works as sweet because Murray is incapable of playing hostility.
Yes, and maybe it is just that, as someone who's loved this movie since I was a kid, it's always in the back of my mind that if she was to outright say no, that he would leave.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just me justifying
it. No, I think it's what passed for flirting in the late 70s, early 80s.
Think
that's
so.
Just how people internalized that attitude.
Yeah.
The sexual revolution was still chugging along and people were, like, literally throwing themselves at each other.
They were. Although, I mean, fortunately, Sigourney Weaver does play... She presents a pretty... I hesitate to use the word strong female character, but, like, she has had a lot of confidence to her.
Sure.
More so than a lot of, like, movie ingenues back in the 80s.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, she's already made Alien and Eyewitness and the big things that define her as a serious sort of kind of competitive street performer. And she's taller than Murray, which is away, like, makes it funny to just put them together. And, and she towers over Rick Moranis, which plays beautifully later on.
Oh, my God, yes.
But, Dana Barrett is not a pushover. She just refuses to be part of whatever game is being played until she's possessed and given no choice, and then Sigourney Weaver gets to really have fun with it.
Which apparently, like, was her audition scene of her just barking like a dog on a table. And not even that they asked her to do it, that she was like, do you want me to do this part? And they were like, go nuts. And she did, and she got the part.
I can see that.
Yeah.
It is, but yeah, I mean, just in terms of which actors are paired up and how these things work, and, you know, they wanted John Candy in originally. You've seen the storyboards, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
They're on that Laserdisc you're holding.
Oh, that's so...
I think it was it Ray who was originally going to be Candy's character? Because they've...
No, they wanted Candy to play Louis Tully.
Oh, that's right.
And he apparently read the script and was like, I just don't get it. Maybe I'll play him as, like, weird and German and he'll own big dogs. And Ivan Reitman was like, no. And eventually John Candy was like, thanks, but no thanks, guys. Thanks for thinking of me. And they sent it to Rick Moranis, who, like, jumped on it.
Sure.
And
God, of course he would.
Made that part incredible.
Yeah. It's, John Candy doing a Teutonic accent thing. It's funny that is always the go-to. Like, Dan Aykroyd wanted to play I can never remember the character's name, but the operative he plays in Gross Point Blank, he was going to do as an East German spy. Who,
really?
Yeah. And they just said, maybe don't do it, Dan. Maybe just play yourself.
Yeah. I see with those guys, there is always an urge to do too much.
Mm.
Just to kind of amuse themselves, especially with Dan Aykroyd, who just loves detail.
Yeah.
Well, almost to a fault.
The story about the script, too, is that they got Ramis to bring in all the humanity because Aykroyd's thing was this arcane pitch set in the future where...
I love it. My secret dream is to meet Dan Aykroyd someday and ask him if a copy of that treatment still exists.
It must be out there. He would never give it away.
I hope to God. For those of you listening at home, even though you're probably not at home right now, the legend of this movie is that Dan Aykroyd originally wrote the concept in the early 80s as a pitch for him and Belushi. Mm-hmm. And it was called... Originally, it was going to be Ghost Smashers, but then they wisely changed it to Ghostbusters. But it was going to be, like you just said, set in the future. They hop dimension to dimension. The Stay Puft Marshmallow Man was, like, page 10. And, like, the first of a dozen large-scale behemoths that they were going to take on.
Yeah, it was basically structured like a video game with boss battles, even though that hadn't happened yet.
Exactly.
Kind of amazing. That's... was predicting those, too, in the early 80s.
Aykroyd's ahead of the curve, man.
You do enough cocaine, you can see the future.
Well, from the sounds of it. There was going to be a lot of pan-dimensional stuff. There was going to be different franchises of Ghostbusters and stuff like that. And the studio and Ivan Reitman looked at it and they were like, this is cool. This would cost $500 million to shoot in 1984 dollars.
Right.
So like you just said, he went to Ramis and he was like, maybe rewrite this with Dan. Maybe make it a going into business story set in the future. Or set in the present day,
right.
And they rewrote it in like 3 weeks, and it's exactly what he said. The other best thing is that this, like I said, it was a treatment that Dan Aykroyd wrote. A movie treatment is like, what, 12 pages, 15 pages?
Yeah, I assume so.
This was like 80-something pages.
So it's a novel.
It's a novel. It's like a short novella of just insanity that Dan Aykroyd wrote, like, just straight from his head, because he is obsessed with the parapsychological and... the technology around it. His family are mediums.
Yeah, I've heard all the stories, and I still can't fully believe that he's integrated into society.
Have you? Oh my God! A couple of years ago, a friend of mine sent me the video for his vodka.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, his Crystal Skullhead vodka, which is good vodka. I like it a whole lot. The one time I had it, I literally just in my head got this panic moment of what if Dan Aykroyd hears me making fun of him, but let's put that away.
That would be great. I would be honored.
Yes. Honestly. That would be a hell of a get.
I did meet him once and I was speechless. It's one of the handful of humans I've ever encountered where I was just like,
ah. Yeah, absolutely. I would lose my mind to meet that
did
guy.
Did not know where to start. He was, it was here. He was in, I'm thinking it was either the Rivoli or the Horseshoe.
Oh, that's so cool.
He was here to promote something and he was going to play music. And it was just one of those early 90s moments where the opportunities lined up and I was there. I'm like, Rob Salem brought me along as his, factotum or something. And I was just like, I don't even know where to start. Don't know where to start. I said, hi, I love your work. I babbled a bit.
It's so... Because, I mean, I'm a big nerd for Saturday Night Live, even to this day, and I find it such a shame, and I guess it just makes sense because it's been 40 years, but how much people forget that he was the quintessential Saturday Night Live player.
He was the first utility player.
Absolutely.
There was nobody else who could do everything.
Everything. Like, just shockingly talented and versatile. The thing I was going to say is his Crystal Skull Vodka video, a friend of mine showed it to me, and he said, for the first 5 minutes... you think Dan Aykroyd has made a hilarious viral video.
Okay.
Because it's him talking about the healing power of crystals and Mayan crystal skulls and how transdimensional beings have influenced Mayan culture and how filtering the vodka through crystals will allow you to get healing energies and stuff like that. You think it's a joke.
You want it to be.
And 5 minutes in of this 10-minute video, you realize he's dead serious about all of it.
He had that show in the 80s too.
Sci Factor.
Which he took apparently quite seriously.
No doubt.
Yeah.
And I love, I have been a lifelong fan of that kind of stuff. Honestly, from this movie. Not that I would say I believe in all of it, but I'm fascinated by it.
Sure.
As a kid, I knew way too much about monsters and ghosts and UFOs and aliens and. To this day, I am obsessed with the Loch Ness Monster more than a grown man should be. my fiance has very graciously agreed that if we end up taking our honeymoon to Europe, that we will make a trip up to there so that I can see that for once in my life.
A pilgrimage.
Kinda.
That's sort of great.
Oh, she's the best.
She gets you. She clearly gets you.
She really does.
This is all by way of me coming back around and saying, yeah, absolutely. When I saw Ghostbusters the first time and then the second and the third and the fourth times, I could completely appreciate the mythology of it. It makes sense. It makes a demented sense. Mm-hmm. But at no point does it give you the time to pick apart Keymasters and Gatekeepers. And the actors are all, not just Aykroyd, but Moranis especially, delivers that stuff with such authority.
Yes.
That just, you know, many, what is it, many sloths and vers were consumed in the mouth of the slur that day, I can tell you.
And that to him is a joke.
Yeah. It's an incredible moment that just makes absolute perfect sense for the character. And it's that thing, that improv point of always telling the truth, like mm-hmm. always be convicted and mm-hmm. committed to whatever it is you're doing. There is so much going on in this. There are terror dogs that come out of statues and ancient building planners that create pyramids. But at no point, and I watched it again a little while ago and just thought, yeah, this holds up. This actually does flow. Mm-hmm. Where do these stairs go? They go up. It doesn't it doesn't matter what else is happening galactically or pan-dimensionally, as long as we are have a rooting interest in what's going on. It's such a simple idea to carry, like a juggernaut, to carry the audience through it.
And you can see, like you said, with Ramis adding the humanity, that they managed to pick all of the perfect moments for Aykroyd to just spew technobabble in a way that deepens the world and makes you feel like I'm seeing a corner of this insane metaphysical world that is out there that Dan Aykroyd's character has obsessively cataloged and knows everything about.
Right.
Like, there's got to be so much out there.
Symmetrical book stacking.
Symmetrical, oh my God.
It's all, and everything is, and for Ray, everything is categorical. Everything mm-hmm. can be cataloged, which is amazing, because then you get Venkman saying, yeah, no human being would stack books like this, which punctures it and lets us laugh, and then sets up the actual unreality of it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you have Ray, the obsessive believer, who wants to catalog all of it and is never not impressed and amazed.
Right.
He's awed by everything that he sees. You have Venkman, who just pulls the air out of everything perfectly. And then you have Egon, who just has such perfect clinical detachment about everything. That in the second movie, they kind of start to border on, like, unhumanity.
Yeah.
Like, just this really unfeeling, I don't want to say cruelty, but...
Well, no, I mean, it's what a sociopath would be,
yeah.
I think, if you extended it a little further.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, he can't feel. He has to be Spock. He has to be the Spock. But even Spock would have moments of humanity that he would see as annoying, but they were still necessary.
Yeah.
And with Egon towards the second film, it's really just, yeah, he kind of has to be super deadpan to balance everything else. But, yeah, I don't know that... Well, we'll get into the sequel because you can't not, but it's one of those things where so much of it feels right that it's frustrating that it doesn't
play. Yeah, you can see where they started to cut corners on the making of it and see how that impacted the final thing, but yeah. And then there's, of course, Winston, who, what a shame to read about how that role rolled out for Ernie Hudson.
Yeah.
Just because, like, I mean, originally, I've always heard that originally they pitched it to Eddie Murphy.
Well, which would make sense at the time.
Right? At the time, yeah.
Coming up, he wasn't a total megawatt star yet, but he was the asset that you wanted in your film if you were making something in the 80s.
I think it's like 48 Hours had just come out,
right.
And it was clear, like, he'd done 2 years on SNL as this brilliant megawatt star that everyone could tell was the most talented person going. And originally, Winston comes in in the first act before they go to the hotel. And the first mission they go on is the four of them together. And there's storyboards for all of it.
Okay.
And then he passed on it, which I also read somewhere a quote of him saying, like, it's the only role he regrets turning down.
I can see that.
But at the time he was like, I'm about to be in Beverly Hills Cop. Like, I don't need to play fourth banana in a movie. But then they pitched it to Ernie Hudson, who was so excited to play this role. And then when he finally gets to set, he sees that they've winnowed it down to this guy who shows up, I think, partway into the second act. And is really just there as an exposition machine. And there was also all this stuff about how Winston Zeddemore was like a PhD and how he was a former military specialist.
Okay.
Like, he was supposed to be like a demolitions guy.
No, that makes sense. Yeah.
And the joke was going to be that while all of them were these sort of various levels of brainiacs and PhDs and scientists, that he was just super capable.
Right.
Like, he was the guy who should be holding a nuclear accelerator, firing it in the middle of a city.
So he's the one with real world experience. And
you know. Exactly. And that he was the one that constantly had to rein them in.
Which would be great for Murphy.
Which would have been great.
Yeah, or for Ernie Hudson, who would have also been really good at that.
He would have been great, but yeah, apparently much to his chagrin, they took the part down a whole lot, and he was very disappointed by it.
Now he's just a blue-collar guy who applies for the job and gets it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Although it does give you that beautiful, beautiful scene in the car with Ray, which is one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie, and maybe one of the best things I think Aykroyd's ever done, because it's that just that little scene where they bullshit and then they're not bullshitting anymore about God.
Yeah.
And it just gives you this sort of gathering darkness that gets you into the third act, but also has that amazing exchange, like, do you believe in God? It's like, I've never met him. That's how you handle it.
Yeah.
Like, even Joss Whedon never came up with an elegant way of sidestepping the absence of God in a supernatural universe.
I know.
And he's had chances. But it just says, I think that's kind of my philosophy, really, is that that is possible, that you can reduce this huge conflict of the dead rising from the grave and New Testament stuff to this tiny little exchange of two people in a car quietly freaking themselves out with the depth and the gravity of what's happening around them. And that, like, those are the moments that make it the Harold Ramis script instead of the Dan Aykroyd script. That so clearly, you know, that those speak to Ramis' interests throughout the rest of his life, throughout the rest of his writing career, but he isn't in it. Because he knows Egon couldn't carry that conversation. He'd shut it down. He'd be too absolutist about it.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah, also, such points to Harold Ramis for setting everyone else up to succeed so much in this movie. Just realizing, because originally he wasn't even sure he was going to be in it. And just as they started to flesh this role out, everyone was like, you seem to have this voice down really well. Do you want to just play it? Sure. He was like, all right. Reitman really had to sell the studio on having him in it because of, you know, Murray, Aykroyd, and then Harold Ramis.
Right.
He was like, the least known.
Like, Stripes hadn't happened.
Yeah.
But, I can see that being one of those weird stumbling blocks where it's like, well, he was in this other movie with Bill Murray, and people might remember that, but we really want to push the Saturday Night Live connection, and this guy was on the other show. Like, there's a million... And as with every movie, there are a million points at which something could go terribly wrong, and we wouldn't get what we get, but Ghostbusters is one of those things where, like, even mismatched effects shots work and feed into this sort of ragged quality. Like,
it has so much momentum that, you're right, they're just charming at this point, as opposed to looking at old movies and being like, oh, that looks bad.
Yeah. There's a close-up of a cake exploding. There's no reason for it, but it's always struck me, even the first time I saw it, like, it's twice as grainy as everything else because of the opticals, and there's just this glorious destruction in the hotel, in that ballroom sequence, and it accomplishes nothing. They just blow up a bunch of food.
Yes.
But it's amateurish in exactly the right way because it's early enough in their careers as professional supernatural exterminators that they don't know what they're doing.
Yes.
And so we are encouraged. Yeah, it is. It's slobs against snobs. It's this incredible underdog story. The scene with the Bill Murray just making fun of that woman's fox rap. It's all there. Like, it all feeds into itself constantly. And it just feels like this creative soup that keeps producing stuff.
Yeah.
It's exciting in a way that, like, how many other billion-dollar franchises were launched by something that just felt this distinctive?
I know. Just so vital and so assured and confident. And just, I would say it's hands down, I think it's Bill Murray's best performance. It's his most...
There's Groundhog Day and Rushmore, but they're very different.
Okay, yeah.
They're so different.
Maybe I shouldn't discount Groundhog Day. And I'm not as big an aficionado of Rushmore to really... I know it's great. I don't question that. It's just a movie I've only ever seen, I think, twice.
Okay.
But yeah, this movie, he's so assured. Every step that he makes is just so confident. And every joke that he makes is a joke that only he could make. And... yeah, I've just never seen him quite pull that off. Because Groundhog Day, I mean, he arguably acts a lot more. He gets a much more distinct arc in it.
Right.
But this is... That is another thing that I kind of love about this movie, is there's not really an arc.
No. Yeah.
Nothing not really changes by the end of it.
Yeah.
None of the characters are affected. None of them have really grown. There's a tiny moment at the end where Egon sets up the plan of, like, okay, if we do this thing where we cross the streams, the thing I said will kill us. It might save the world, but it'll probably kill us. And you just see it reads on all their faces as a joke moment. And then Bill Murray just makes the decision of, like, I love this plan. I'm excited to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And you see the only moment in the movie where he does something noble, which is, I am going to use this weird charisma that I have to talk all of my buddies into committing suicide.
Yeah.
To save the world. And, oh, and there's a beautiful moment a second later, and maybe I've just read too much into this, where...
Oh, no, it's when they think Dana's dead. I know.
No. It's before that. Okay. It's, which, by the way, that is also a great moment. But when they're about to turn on their proton packs to shoot, to cross the streams, and he says, see you on the other side, Ray. And Ray looks at him and says, nice working with you, Dr. Venkman. And it's the only time someone calls him doctor in the movie that's not meant to be a burn.
Right.
That's not meant to undermine him. Because every time it's like, Dr. Venkman, like, no one really believes he's a doctor.
Yeah.
And it's the only time one of his friends says it from a place of respect. And I'm like, oh, that is kind of a moment.
Yeah.
But that's as much of an arc as the movie has.
Yeah. It's funny, too. There's a line. Oh, there was an episode of Judge John Hodgman of the podcast where they mentioned something about Ghostbusters. And it's on their website. I'm part of the public record. I was compelled to put on my OCD film critic hat and explain that there is a world of... there's a world of history, of backstory, in that early scene where Venkman asks a question and Stance responds with, you never studied. And he says it lovingly. And it's because this is the thing. Like, Ray and probably Egon have had to work at this. They have done this all their lives. They have been really, really good at the academic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Venkman's a natural.
Yes.
We see it in the initial sequence where he's torturing the kid with electric shocks.
Oh, my God.
Because... the punchline to that joke, and it's buried, and I'm sure it's a Ramis joke, not an Eckerd joke.
Yeah.
The punchline to that joke is that his theory is correct. That he is right about... because when we find out what the experiment is, it's the stimulation of electricity to provoke...
Yeah, I'm checking the effect of negative reinforcement on ESP abilities.
Right, and it works.
Yes.
And, you know, like, the kid, the joke is, I'll tell you the effect, it's pissing me off, and then it says, perhaps my theory is correct. And it is!
Yeah.
He's good at what he does. He's just so... lazy.
It's just that that last card that he picks is so specific.
Yeah.
That he actually gets it right and clearly must be
he's
telepathic at this point.
He has made it work.
Yes.
But the joke is that it also pisses you off into having powers is so great. And they never followed up, and I was kind of hoping there'd be a return to it in the sequel, but it's just such a throwaway line. But then
you by the way, the best thing about that scene is that Venkman doesn't notice.
Right.
That he's only focused on trying to pick up this co-ed. And he doesn't notice that he proved his theory correct.
Right. Unless that's the whole plan, and the negative reinforcement is also ignoring the guy.
Oh, wow. That
see?
Would be... I don't know.
It's...
I could see that being possible.
The scene supports the theory. I have watched this movie enough times. But that's, like, that's one of those things where I think about the generosity of Harold Ramis in setting all that stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
And the actor's warmth is what sells Ray's line.
Yeah.
And then pays off in the end with that Dr. Venkman thing. It is just... these are the things where either... they are so baked into the concept by that point that they evolve naturally. Or the actors' relationships are informing the characters' relationships, and you get that stuff coming up naturally. But it still feels like it's all part of this one thing that has thought about these characters and loves the characters as much as it loves the mythology and all the elaborate effects stuff, if not more so.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, this is... one of the reasons I love this movie so much is because... character isn't the thing I always write first.
Okay.
It's something that I find I actually have to sit down and really intellectualize and think about. And this movie is such a beautiful character comedy, and it just succeeds so much on that start to finish. It seems effortless, but like you said, it's just because they did all the work ahead of time, and it shows. It's all there, and it's what drives the movie. You like these guys.
Yeah.
You want to watch these guys.
Yeah.
And that's enough to carry a movie start to finish.
Yeah, and the I guess it's mise-en-scene, but the surrounding, the world that is constructed around them is simultaneously a preposterous, exaggerated, snooty society film that these guys can Marx Brothers their way through.
Oh, yeah.
But it's also an amazing snapshot of 1980s New York.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, like, I'm just... I can't believe that, they marshaled the shoot the way they did, that they actually managed to produce this film in New York City.
Yeah.
At a point in time where everybody was hostile and miserable and...
And that's a thing that they return to in the sequel that I feel like they then overplay too much.
Yeah.
That idea of the cartoon, like, hey, I'm walking here! Everyone shouting at each other constantly in miserable New York.
Yeah, and I get why they did it to feed into the whole mood slam thing, but at the same time, you're almost playing against... you're playing too hard into it.
It feels like a cartoon.
Yeah, and there's just no... Well, and the larger problem with Ghostbusters 2 is that there's no justification for almost anything that happens. It's all so completely random, which they still play with really well, but, you know, given the way that you can reduce all of Ghostbusters 2, it's not the girl, it's the building, which is just, again, we thought about this, we know exactly what we're doing, and it's kind of a twist in a comedy, which... you weren't expecting any twists from.
Yeah.
Two is just, well, there's this evil painting.
Yeah.
And I do love Peter McNichol, and...
Sure.
I have a photo...
Funnily enough, Eastern European accent.
That's right.
He plays the...
Janusz Pocha.
I remember
the character's name. and he's delightful. He's a wonderful, wonderful character.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I drippings with goo? is a line reading I sadly have used twice in my life. But yeah, I think what's wonderful about... the original Ghostbusters is a film that was produced, although it was incredibly expensive and complicated, it was a film produced with very little expectation.
Yeah.
We're going to put this out there and it'll make money and we'll be fine. And it was just an incredibly cynical production move that turned out to be an amazingly genuine film.
Oh, yeah.
And the sequel, while I kind of love it for what it is,
sure,
is also not a lot of stuff that it could be or should be.
I mean, I have a lot of residual fondness for the sequel because it was came out when I was about 9 years old. I was obsessed with the cartoon,
right?
Which was really my entry point into all of this.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask where it started for you. So you started watching the real Ghostbusters.
The real Ghostbusters. And then I remember the first time I ever would have seen the movie would have been on TV. And I remember being very scared of it.
So had you seen the first one before the sequel?
Yes.
Okay.
But not in a way that I was, like, obsessive about it or really, like, knew everything that happened in it. It was more just that I liked the cartoon a lot. And so the sequel movie played really well for me because the sequel movie feels a lot more like the cartoon in a lot of ways.
Okay, yeah.
They don't smoke anymore.
Yeah, it's less concerned with real world politics and things. They sort of dispense with that in one scene.
Yeah, Winston had to shave his mustache so that he would look like the cartoon character.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they made Ernie Hudson shave. He looks... not as cool without a mustache.
That's true.
I met that guy at Comic-Con a couple of weeks ago, or a couple months ago, and to this day he still has the mustache, because that man should.
Yeah, I interviewed him when I think Leviathan was coming back out on Blu-ray. That was the excuse.
Sure.
He was in this anthology film that Sony Pictures was putting out on DVD, but the Leviathan release was the following week, and it's just like, I think that's really more important to me.
Yeah.
He's one of those character actors who seems very bemused with his level of recognizability, I guess, or just the fact that people light up when they see him, because you don't have negative memories of Ernie Hudson. He doesn't play heavies in the same way he plays good guys and supporting characters.
True.
You just like him. It's fun to see him and stuff.
Oh, my God. Speaking of the few people that I could meet in my life that I would really lose my mind over, I felt like a child. It was the best.
That is great.
It was really dumb, too, because I have a poster that I had always hoped that I would get signed by all of them. I will never get it signed by Harold Ramis now,
sure.
But the only one that I had it signed by for a long time was Bill Murray, the one person I never expected to sign it. But I got it at the Bill Murray Day at TIFF.
Oh, nice.
Because at the end of the day, even though they said people weren't going to do it, everyone just rushed the stage and he signed stuff.
Everybody does, yeah.
And I was like, I'll take it. I don't care. This is the best. But yeah, I got Ernie Hudson to sign it, and I blurted out something dumb about, like, I'm really sorry to ask you to sign a poster that doesn't have you on it. And I think he got the impression that I was, like, that I was an eBay guy. Like, I was just going to sell it.
Yeah.
And then at the end, I was just... blabbering on about, like, it's really nice to meet you, like, this is really great. And he was like, do you want me to personalize it to you? And I was like, could you?
Aww.
And he was like, oh yeah, sure. And then at that point he realized that I wasn't just going to sell it. I will hand it down to my children. But anyway, back to the sequel.
Oh, no, this is all valid. This is all great stuff. I was just going to say, the growing eBay commercialization of signed, it sucks.
It's I hate it.
Because not only is it base and corrupt, but it has become so much of an industry now that you cannot have a genuine moment with someone where you say, I really love you in this thing, because they think you're buttering them up to get a better signature. So, yeah, I mean, I almost never get autographs. I'm not an autograph collector.
Neither am I. This is literally the...
Temptation is so there, though, for the big stuff.
Oh, for sure. This is the only time I've ever lined up at a convention to get something signed.
Right. But it's that important to you.
Yeah. And for this, like, I'll of course do it. And, I mean, I hope someday I can get Aykroyd to sign it if I can, but...
Well, if he hears this, he can contact us directly on Twitter.
Yay! Yeah, he used to do signings for his vodka a lot, but I think that has fallen by the wayside. And from the sounds of it, everyone just used to go and get Ghostbusters memorabilia signed.
Yeah.
But yeah, no. Yeah, that sequel, I think it's just... They've talked a lot about it. They sat around, they batted around ideas. I think Murray was more involved in the creation of it this time, or at least as much as he cared to be.
Right.
And as he famously has said, the effects took over, and it became a lot more about, like, what can we do on screen? And that was what was driving a lot of the story. And, yeah, there's just a lot of really half-baked jokes in it. A lot of jokes that you can tell were improvised that aren't very good.
Yeah.
Like, there's a joke where they show up at the restaurant wearing all the, like, rain gear so they can go in the sewer. And he's like, let me guess, all you can eat night at the Sizzler. And I'm like, ugh. It's like a bad sitcom joke. And here's the thing that, to me, ruins the movie. I can't not notice it now. Obviously, the first movie has a beautiful score. Elmer Bernstein's score is magnificent.
It really is, yeah.
It's weird and esoteric, and it's, like, the first half is a lot of theremin.
Yeah, it's occasionally inappropriate.
Yeah.
In a way that it shouldn't be. Like, the sort of jaunty piano march thing
yes.
that they do.
And then the end is just, like, pure old Hollywood, like, it sounds like King Kong.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. I love it. It's a great score. And then the second movie score sounds like some guy on a Casio keyboard. Like, it sounds like it should be the score to, like, Look Who's Talking.
Yeah.
Which I pick as a late 80s comedy. Maybe that had a good score. I don't know.
Nah, probably not.
But it sounds cheap.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I wonder, because I know the production problems with the film were such that, yeah, the effects took forever, too. So maybe they just didn't have a lot of time, and it's a really rushed kind of fill at the last.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Production, but so much of it feels like they're racing against a clock because they have a date instead of an idea.
Right.
Which was what happened with the first film, but somehow it worked out.
I think it was just the first film. They were all just young guys who didn't know any better.
Yeah.
And they were like, "We're gonna throw this thing together and get it out. Let's have as much fun as we can." Because if anything, we're under such a time crunch now that no one can really say no to us.
Right.
So let's just make this movie as fun as we can. Let's make ourselves laugh. Whereas the second one, like you said, was all production, and we have to get this shot in, and we have to get this slate so that they can do this effects shot. And
We don't have this many days with Viggo. You only have to do the makeup on Aykroyd.
Who, by the way, apparently the guy who played Viggo, kind of an asshole.
Yes, I've heard about this.
There's a huge maniac.
I think it was on the AV Club. There was this long piece about how kind of miserable he's made other people.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's good casting.
Yeah, he looks great.
It's who you want for a conqueror.
He does look like a conqueror, for sure. And again, I love that concept. The same way that, like, the first movie is all about crazy turn-of-the-century architects making New York skyscrapers into telemetry antennas that are gateways to another dimension to bring a Mesopotamian god to destroy the world. Like, that's insane world building that I love.
Yeah. It's like Anton LaVey and who's the other one? Crowley. Like, all just every weird arcana thing that Aykroyd had absorbed in some bookstore in St. Mark's Place all barfing out into one moment.
Absolutely, but it's cohesive. And even in the second movie, the idea of, like, what it would have been, like, 1200s despot from Europe who was such a terrible guy, like, kind of Vlad the Impaler style. Yeah.
Genghis Khan,
yeah.
Everything.
Yeah, who's been, like...
What is it? It is my favorite line in the entire movie. It's like, and just before his head died.
Yes.
He said, death is but a door, I shall return.
Yeah, death is but a door, time is but a window, I shall be back.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
And of course, the painting is the window. Woo.
Sorry to be a nerd and
correct you. No, God, please. That's, I love it when people are better researched than I am.
I'm sloppy. But yeah, like, there's neat stuff in the movie. And the idea of, like, emotions coalescing into a psychokinetic slime that can do things. Like, that's a cool concept.
Yeah, and it's, if you're going to locate it anywhere. Dexter.
Oh, it's okay.
You ruin our rhythm.
No, it's totally fine. I will say, I've listened to a lot of these podcasts. If I heard a dog delightfully scratching himself in the background, I would not mind.
Nah, snoring, sighing. People, there are episodes where it sounds like I'm sighing at someone.
Oh, no.
Like some really great point comes out, and then you hear...
Take that, Scott Thompson.
Yeah, you were trying... Well, Dexter slept on Scott Thompson. That went great.
Aww.
But yeah, if you're going to set a... if you're going to set a movie anywhere where that can happen, New York is the best location for it, because at that point it was a caricature of itself, and it kind of still is. Mm-hmm. Only now it's too expensive for angry people to live there. They have to go to Brooklyn or Jersey or Queens.
By the way, I will be very surprised if in the new Ghostbusters movie they actually set up shop in Manhattan.
I wonder.
I suspect they won't be able to afford to.
Yeah.
I bet that'll be a joke, but I don't know. By the way, just a thing because I love ripping on people who make fun of the new Ghostbusters movie. Sure. I saw a lot of people who are mad that they're like, they shot this movie in Boston. Why wasn't it all shot in New York City? And I'm like, you realize the original Ghostbusters wasn't all shot in New York City.
Yeah, a lot of it's in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Right? Like the interior of the firehouse is a firehouse in L.A. that's also in The Mask.
Oh, yeah.
If you remember, when he gets his car fixed... There's like some auto garage that he drops his car off and then he goes back to. It's the same place.
Cool.
Yeah. So it's like the exterior of the firehouse is in New York.
Oh, yeah.
It's
in Tribeca. It's 2 blocks from a friend's restaurant.
Cool.
Yeah. Locanda Verde, Andrew Carmelini, who actually has an episode of this podcast. It's coming.
Cool.
Yeah. But Locanda Verde is in the Greenwich Hotel, which is 2 blocks away. If you get off, the one train at the Franklin Street exit, that is the firehouse.
Oh, I've been.
And this is so embarrassing. I have never recognized it.
Oh, really?
I've walked past it literally dozens of times.
It's a little bit off the beaten path. Yeah. It's a bit of a side street.
But I just never made the connection that it was the firehouse.
Yeah.
And Kate was, we watched the movie 2 years ago, I guess, and she'd never watched it as an adult, and said, oh, that's the one near Locanda Verde, that's the firehouse. And I'm like, no, that can't be right. It's Broome Street? No, that's not right. And in fact, it is.
Yeah, no.
I am bad at locations in the flesh. 3 dimensions are useless.
Yeah, no, it's a neat location. When my fiancé and I were down in New York City a couple of years ago, we were going to a restaurant also down in that neighborhood, and we elected to stop. I was like, can we please just go out of our way? And the pattern that comes up with a lot of our traveling.
Sure.
But we stopped there. Oh, and we went to the public library too on Fifth Street.
Oh, you cannot.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, it's just a magnificent feat of architecture to begin with. But, that was a cool thing to see. Yeah.
If you come into the city at Grand Central Station, you kind of almost invariably have to walk past it at some point. Mm-hmm. So it's just this little moment of pure happy.
Oh, it's, God. Yeah, the architecture in that city, I mean... Have you heard that the architecture in New York is beautiful?
It's almost like it's a character in the movie.
Yes. you've seen They Came Together, right?
Yeah. Which was shot in Brooklyn.
Well, they couldn't afford
to shoot in New York. I talked to Wayne about that, and he said there's one scene where they had to CG the name of the subway station to make it appear to be in Manhattan.
Oh, my God.
And they only had the money to do it in 2 shots out of the 3 that it appears in. And so the second one, you can actually see the real name. And I caught it. And I said, well, you shot there. And I said, I mean, I saw the name of the station. It's like, yeah, we could only animate toys.
That's so funny.
But it's just too expensive. Like, what's the line? The Richard LeGrevenis was telling me in the last 5 years, there's a scene where, I mean, the brownstone where the characters live is on West 73rd, because that's what it says in the song. We found a little place on West 73rd, but they had to shoot it in Harlem. That was the only place they could find the bay window that looked right and could actually afford to shoot it.
Wow.
So, yeah, New York has priced itself out of almost everything. Yeah. And I think on some level, part of that is a reaction to the you know, the Made in NYC thing where they've actually got studios now mm-hmm. in Brooklyn and Queens that can right. accommodate shooting, and they'd rather people shoot on sets.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, apparently this movie, Ghostbusters, famously made the traffic miserable downtown.
Oh, yeah, yeah. For like, months.
Shooting
downtown and on Central Park West.
Yeah, shooting the scene in Central Park West outside Dana's building, which is there, and by the way, is much shorter in real life.
Yeah.
There was that great story about Asimov that they were shooting the whole crowd sequence where they're going to go in the building and everyone's cheering Ghostbusters.
Right.
And they famously just snarled traffic across all of Manhattan.
Would not be surprised.
For this. Everyone was miserable. And apparently, Isaac Asimov lived in the neighborhood at the time and came along to the shooting, and someone told Aykroyd that he was there. And Aykroyd lost his mind, of course. And he was like, "Mr. Asimov, I'm a huge fan of yours. I, you know, really, really big fan." And he was like, "Do you know who's making this thing?" And he was like, "Yeah, yeah, that's the movie that we're shooting." And Asimov was just like, "I hate it. It's ruining everything in the neighborhood." He was so crabby and mad about it.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yes.
It's actually the perfect news. That's probably what inspired the plot of Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah, probably.
Long actually. Simmering rage and disappointment that Aykroyd felt.
Oh, I know.
Oh, that's incredible. The only other time I can remember that level of resentment in New York towards a shoot was I Am Legend. Will Smith thing where, like, Kate was there. We were there for the shoot of it, and I was...
Oh, you mean beloved cinema masterpiece, I Am Legend?
Well, you know, if you're going to destroy New York's traffic patterns from like 5 a.m. to 10 a.m. every day for 3 months.
Oh, my
So
Lord.
You can catch two scenes.
Oh, my Lord.
You should really make it, you know, make them make that. You should make New Yorkers make that sacrifice for a tremendous piece of cinema. And while I will argue that I Am Legend is a really good New York movie for the first 20 minutes, because it is incredible to consider that landscape without people.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, what a waste.
Oh, my
but
God.
But there were daily updates on radio about where you shouldn't go, about which buildings would be in the eye line of the camera, because they didn't want to have to CG people out of it. So apparently there were people in offices just giving the finger to the camera. 6 a.m. "Mom, turning my fucking light on. What are you going to do? Oh, is Will Smith going to come up here and tell me I should turn off my light? I will do that for Will Smith and no one else." It was just...
Take that, the Fresh Prince.
The amazing hostility. Yeah, you're not even from here. The amazing hostility that came out of that in the city. And that's in, like, 2000, and I want to guess... Six?
Something
seven?
Like that, yeah.
Yeah, it must have been 2007.
It was prettier, yeah.
That was the summer that Kate was there.
Man.
And it was just so... Like, people were just so primed to be mad at it.
Oh, I know. I'm actually amazed at how much the new Marvel, the Netflix shows, shoot in New York.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it really, it shows. They get a lot of great production value out of just shooting on rooftops.
Yeah.
And with the skyline in the background.
Yeah, and there was an elaborate, I remember the sequence in Jessica Jones where they try to catch David Tennant was shot on, like, that's Union Square. I know those blocks.
It's
14th Street and Broadway, and clearly during the day with people.
Mm-hmm.
That should be impossible.
I guess. Although those shows, for as good as they are relatively small scale. So yeah. I'd imagine that whatever they're shutting down is not, like, we're not shutting down, like, 5 square blocks of Manhattan.
Yeah.
We're shutting down, like, an intersection.
And this corner, yeah.
Yeah.
Plus, actually, that piece of 14th Street where Broadway is really just a laneway.
Mm-hmm.
You could probably divert traffic fairly easily if you really wanted to, like, on a Sunday morning and fake it.
Yeah, definitely. And if you're just up on rooftops, I mean, that's as long as you can crop out anyone watching you. Yeah. I'm sure that's actually pretty doable.
Yeah. As opposed to Ghostbusters, which is... So much of it is street level and people interacting with doorways and crossings and just the thick of humanity. Yeah. I don't think there's a scene in the subway in the first movie, is there? But there could have been for the level of complexity. They might as well have shot in the subway.
Oh my God, yeah. Although, don't they have like a few derelict subway stations that they use just for, like, the way we use Lower Bay Station?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I know that Cloverfield was sort of cool. I was there in the summer that they were shooting Cloverfield.
Really?
Unwittingly walked through the set.
Oh, no.
Yeah, on Central Park South, they come up into... It's the end of the subway sequence where they pop up after of the sixth line. They emerge near... like basically near the plaza.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the exit is in Bergdorf Goodman's or something. And they come out through a shopping center. And I was above it, and I had no idea, because nobody knew what it was, obviously.
Right.
There was just this secret thing that was going on.
Sure. J.J. Abrams and his secrets.
Yeah, and then that whole sequence in Central Park, when they end up in Central Park West in the two towers, was shot in Los Angeles on sets, because they couldn't do it in New York.
Right.
But the geography on the ground had to be real.
Mm-hmm.
So they were blocking off half a lane, and then at night they shut down the whole box. So I don't think even the horses and carriages could get through.
Oh my God.
But like that doesn't happen anymore because you have to be making a studio film. It's prohibitively expensive.
Oh yeah.
So anybody making a small film like They Came Together or in the last 5 years, you're going to shoot that in Brooklyn, or you're going to shoot in Harlem. I think John McGarry was telling me he shot scenes in his own apartment for the men just because it was cheaper than renting studio space in New York.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, and it's how you survive now as a small scale film, but Ghostbusters is a film that had like the full faith and credit of Columbia Pictures behind it.
Also, I mean, they've talked a lot with this movie about how by that time, Murray and Aykroyd were kind of just New York folk heroes from their Saturday Night Live days.
Sure, yeah.
So they bought a lot of goodwill for what they were doing with that. Plus,
well, the autograph scene at the end is basically just them signing autographs, right?
They just
I think so. I want to say that it went on longer because there are a few scenes where they're just sort of hanging out with people at the very end.
Oh, that's cool.
Cheering, and some of it is just caught footage on the fly of like, yeah, just keep it rolling. Because film, like, it wasn't that expensive then.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. Oh, and apparently, they drove the car around a lot. And whenever people would be like, what are you guys doing? And they're like, we're making Ghostbusters. Or they would say, like, we're the Ghostbusters or something like that, just to try and get this weird urban legend going of what that meant. So by the time the movie came out, a lot of people in New York were really on board with it in a way that it hadn't even been promoted yet, which I kind of love.
Sort of pre-viral marketing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And working to include the city... Goodwill is a character, weirdly, you know, like just that little montage where they're on Larry King and everything else.
I love that.
And Aykroyd was famously upset that they had to cut. Ramis told the story, and the dog is having a dream now.
Hopefully a good dream.
Yeah. Ramis told the story that the one thing that either Aykroyd or Reitman never forgave them for cutting because they wanted it in there was, maybe, no, sorry, I'm wrong. Reitman tells the story about how Ramis and Aykroyd never forgave him for cutting a digression where someone asks Stance if he knows there's a movie called The Ghostbusters. And he does explain, like, he talks about it. There's a little, like, a 30-second thing about, oh, yeah, I know, it's this famous old movie. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was this first understanding that there might be copyright issues down the line.
Well, apparently, when... Even into production, they were still calling it Ghost Smashers.
Which is such a terrible title.
Terrible title. There are takes of everyone outside of Dana Barrett's apartment building, that whole crowd screaming, Ghost Smashers, Ghost Smashers. But then apparently they filmed it with them saying Ghostbusters, and they famously called the Columbia studio exec who was in charge of it and held up the phone of everyone like chanting it, and they were like, looks like you're gonna have to clear it, goodbye. And then that was it. But yeah, that is another thing that, sorry to keep harping on this, but that drives me nuts about people who insist that there could never be another Ghostbusters,
right,
is that this is a concept that's been around and redone for decades. There are so many other versions of this. There is the Ghostbusters TV show, the kids show from the 70s,
right,
which predates this.
Had a gorilla. Correctly. Because why wouldn't you?
It was like two guys from F Troop.
Yeah, like and, a Storch and somebody else.
Yeah, and a guy in a gorilla costume, and they were called the Ghostbusters.
And it was terrible.
Oh, it was awful. It was brutally awful.
I was there for that. I remember that. Oof. It was awful. I mean, I can't imagine what it would look like to a kid looking back.
I would imagine even as a child back then, you were like, this is off. But yeah, it's really cheesy, but at the same time, all the fundamentals are there. Dumb guy, like goofy guys who use technology to fight the supernatural.
Right.
And then you even go back further, like there was the Bowery Brothers movie from the 40s, which was Ghost...
Chasers?
Ghost Chasers? No, Spookbusters.
Oh, right.
Which I assure you is not racist.
No, thankfully.
Yeah, I know, right? Real touch and go there. And then there was the Bob Hope one that was Ghost Breakers, which I watched a little while ago. Which, I'd never seen a Bob Hope old-timey movie before, which was very fun.
Yeah, those are interesting in a completely different aesthetic experience. Like, you're just watching Bob Hope be Bob Hope, much as the same way you're watching Bill Murray be Bill Murray.
Absolutely.
But there's far more of a framework around Murray than there is Hope.
For sure. Yeah, and even that movie, it was like, he's like a radio DJ, or he's a radio announcer who talks about the mob. And then the mob gets mad at him, and he thinks he's killed a mobster. So he follows this heiress to Cuba, where she's inherited a castle. This is like the first 45 minutes of the movie, where he follows her to this castle, realizes he didn't actually kill the guy, and it never becomes a plot point again.
Right.
And then they go to this castle, which is purportedly haunted, and he declares himself a ghost breaker, like a strike breaker, and he's going to go in and clear out these ghosts. Right. And him and his huge African-American caricature sidekick go through it, and they get scared, and they end up revealing the plot to scare her off. But then in the end, there are real ghosts, and yeah, it was just...
Yeah.
But overstuffed.
Still, it was three or four movies stapled together.
Oh, for sure. It was. You could tell that they were just making it as they went. And like you said, it was just an excuse for Bob Hope to be Bob Hope all the way through it.
That's all anybody wanted.
Yeah. It's him and his goofy sidekick giving huge reaction shots, and that's the whole movie. But
right, well, and every Abbott and Costello movie. Like, that was the...
Well, Abbott and Costello meet the...
Meet Frankenstein, meet the mummy, meet the monsters. Yeah, as was the style at the time, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's just how it was.
Like, this whole idea of... goofy paranormal investigators meet the supernatural. Like, that's an old trope.
Oh, yeah.
That has been around a long time. It's just that Ghostbusters was the first one to land with such a cultural impact that at this point, people assume they invented that trope.
Right.
And...
Well, they perfected it.
Well, they perfected it, for sure, yeah.
It is... That's why there's the logo. That's why... those are iconic things that became iconic because... The package delivered, like, everything was what it needed to be, and it is it's just delightful from start to finish. But yeah, the idea that, you know, there was a sequel and there was an animated series, this is not like the, yes, all the same characters were there, but it's not set in stone that it's inviolate.
Yes, exactly.
And you can have, you know, if the Marvel Universe hadn't happened, then sure, a reboot with Robert Downey Jr., Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah.
Oh, I can do this. Yeah, you could do it with the cast of a Marvel movie,
mm-hmm.
and it would be fun and different and still the same.
I guarantee you that within our lifetimes, probably within the next couple decades, we will see the Marvel Universe reboot.
Probably.
They'll start from scratch.
How many Spider-Man films are there? Different ones.
Oh my god, yes.
There's three, right? They've just launched a third one.
And I will say, I buy the argument that they needed to do it a third time just to get it right.
Yeah. Well, certainly what happens in Civil War is enough to convince me that, yeah, okay, you got me.
Yeah. I mean,
whatever it is, this is maybe not how it should have been all along, but how it needs to be now.
I will also say, as much as I do have fondness for those Raimi movies, I do feel like a lot of people remember them with rose-tinted glasses.
Oh, sure.
There's stuff in those movies that are corny as heck.
Yeah. But Spider-Man was corny. Well, like, he's allowed to be corny?
He is, except he's not. In the movie, it's always jokes happening at his expense, and he's rarely the comedic driver of
it. That's true. Only in the third one, and that doesn't work.
Oh, my goodness, no.
But I think that's what Andrew Garfield got right. Like, what those movies get right is how much of an annoying
character
Spider-Man is allowed to be.
Of course, but then they also slop on three different plots of him having a secret past and stuff that that doesn't serve the movie and no one really cares about, and it's all at cross purposes. That second movie is... There's good stuff in there, but it's a hot mess.
Yeah, let's spend 30 minutes on backstory that doesn't matter.
Holy smokes, yes.
Yeah, and won't pay off.
Won't pay off, ever. You're never going to care about this stuff.
Yeah, say what you will. You know, Melissa McCarthy's not going to have some sort of secret subway base. Oh, maybe she will, actually, and I'd be fine
never
with that
know.
In the new Ghostbusters. But what we will get, and I avoid trailers and marketing as much as I possibly can, but I was trapped in a theater with the Ghostbusters trailer, the first one.
Sure.
And I'm excited about it because, like every Paul Feig film, it's a terrible marketing package.
That is true.
No one has ever successfully managed to sell a Paul Feig film.
I don't know if it's that...
Like, Spies trailer was a mess.
Yeah. I don't know if it's that the studios don't know what to do, or if it's just that his comedy needs to breathe.
Mm.
And I want to say it's that. It's very... Well, I've read reports of people who are at some cinema convention... like a month ago, who saw some extended scenes from the movie, and they were like, yeah, I think so. And they're like, they play a lot better.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure they do. His stuff is all about timing and reaction shots and mm-hmm. and like, yeah, letting it breathe. And the other thing that makes me really excited is that Kate McKinnon has no dialogue, but every shot of her is hysterical.
I know.
She's pulling these bizarre faces and giggles and big open mouth grins. And, like, I want that. I want that in a Ghostbusters movie. I want that sort of joy.
Yeah.
Instead of terror.
Yes.
This should be the best job in the world.
I also can't get over people who are like, they made this new one a comedy.
Yeah.
I'm like, I've honestly argued with people online because that's how I procrastinate from writing.
Me too.
But yeah, I've seen people claim they're making the new Ghostbusters with women a comedy. It's supposed to be a horror movie. And I'm like, what planet do you live on?
Oh, no. I mean, everyone remembers the original Ghostbusters is about the existential dread that comes with the discovery of the paranormal.
For sure. Yeah, that's all they spend their time on. And there's a handful of jokes.
It's got two scares and a blowjob joke. Come on.
I know. And I get that, like, when I was 5 years old, that movie scared me.
Sure.
But because I was five. But yeah, no. And also, bear in mind, I don't necessarily think the new one will be good. It could not be good. Mm. I just can't get behind the irrational hate of it.
Yeah, I refuse to. There are very few things that I will condemn just on instinct, mm-hmm. on reflex. And generally when that happens, it's because, you know, to use my standard line, Transformers 5 is probably going to be just as good as Transformers 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Well, there you go.
And I've seen them all, and I've suffered through them, and yeah, I'm going to do the next one because I'm an idiot. But
well, you also get paid for your
job.
Time.
Yeah, it's what I do. I'm paid to suffer. Mm-hmm. So, and apparently my editor thinks it's fun to send me these things. He did, like, there was one earlier this year. It's like, oh, you should take that one. It'll be fun to read.
Yeah.
And like, you can tell sometimes when a dog is coming. You can feel it.
For sure.
But the idea
cough, that... Batman versus Superman cough.
Well, yeah. But again, we had Man of Steel, right? The example had already been set.
Yes.
The creative team reunites. Do they have to? But with this, it's that these are people that I love mm-hmm. doing things that could be really good mm-hmm. or really bad, but absolutely they get the benefit of the doubt, and it doesn't have anything to do with gender. It's just, this is a new take on an old thing. That's what we're supposed to want.
I also love how people constantly say, well, Melissa McCarthy's not funny, so... Yeah. And I'm like, you've noticed that her movies are some of the highest grossing comedies of the last 5 years, right?
Yeah. It's just that you don't think you're laughing at them, but you probably paid to see them.
Either that or...
There must be some return on investment.
You're mistaking your opinion for an objective fact.
On the internet?
On the internet, I know, right? But particularly with this, I've just seen so many people... Like, everyone knows Melissa McCarthy and Kristen Wiig aren't funny. And I'm like, no, a lot of people think they're tremendously funny.
Yeah.
And say what you will about Saturday Night Live, it is one of the highest-rated comedies on television.
Yeah.
And Leslie Jones and Kate McKinnon are crushing it on that show right now.
Yeah, there is no piece of this movie that I am not prepared to like, because I know I like the things that are in it. I like the package. And it's Ghostbusters. It's
exactly.
The first Ghostbusters movie since 1989. I'm gonna hope that it works.
Yes, exactly.
You pull for it, so, and, you know, like, and what,
I know, it's so maddening.
These incoherent objections that make me incoherent in response, but yeah, I mean, the worst thing that could happen is that maybe they make another Ghostbusters and it has guys in it. Like, you should still want this to succeed to keep the brand going.
Absolutely.
If you love the brand that much, right? Yes. Like, you should root for this.
And Lord almighty, the people who say, why didn't they make a sequel?
Yeah.
Have you seen an Ivan Reitman comedy in 15 years? Have you listened to Dan Aykroyd?
Yeah, his pitches have not gotten any better or different for the next one. God bless him, he created this, and I will always love him for it.
Oh my goodness, yes.
But I think we can be realistic that this isn't necessarily the best way to steer the franchise. It's, again, with Star Trek, with Star Wars... George Lucas saying, Force Awakens was okay. Yeah, I'd expect that from George Lucas. He's demonstrated that he doesn't know what Star Wars needs.
Absolutely.
And maybe, just let the people who made the funny thing you like more recently run with it is not the worst way to strategize.
Or let the people who made the funny thing that you don't like run with it and accept that you were never going to get the thing that was in your head.
Right.
And that someone making a new thing... Even if you've decided that you like it, has no bearing on the old thing. This phrase, I know it's such a cliche to be upset with someone saying, this is ruining my childhood, but nothing ever gets ruined. Nothing gets ruined retroactively. If anything, the idea of them making a third sequel to the movie, where Murray barely wants to be in it, they have to justify why Ramis is dead, and Winston and Ray are the through lines...
Right.
Or
we meet their kids.
Or we meet their kids.
Pitched a number of times and is never a good idea.
Yeah, I remember for a long time it was going to be Michael Cera playing Oscar from Ghostbusters 2.
I mean, I'll watch it, but...
Oh, no, for sure. I'll give any of this a chance, but at the same time, I don't need a lot of, isn't it funny that we're all too old to do this jokes.
Right, yeah.
That, in a weird way, ruins this more for me than a reboot.
Right. Yeah, I don't want to see old Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
I mean, if... And they've since walked back the tease in the trailer about 30 years ago, Scientists Save New York. So
weird idea.
It's unconnected, which is great because they should be starting from scratch because Absolutely. Then you get to watch them figure it out.
Yes.
But I also don't think I want to see Grandpa Venkman or anything like that just sort of wander in. There's no point. Like, let something else pass the baton, but don't do it on screen. Just let it happen.
Yes. Absolutely.
I believe in this. So, which, suck it, man babies. So,
yay.
Yeah. So we buried that one. And now that we've settled that forever.
Yeah, forever, yes.
I get to ask the closer, which is, you know, like, what of Ghostbusters, and it sounds like a lot, have you absorbed personally into your DNA? What's become part of your creative philosophy?
Too much.
Well, everything has to have a ghost in it.
Everything has to have, well, I don't know, buddy. I have pushed that at Degrassi so many times. No, I mean, obviously, ever since I was a kid, I'm obsessed with monsters and supernatural and stuff like that. And given my druthers, I would write not but stories about that. I think that was a lot of why I was so primed to love Buffy the Vampire Slayer the way I did when it came out.
Sure.
Again, I even Supernatural, which I think is a better show than people give it credit for, if maybe not one for the ages, is a show that's just, it's the blue collar versus the supernatural. And I will always buy a ticket for that. But in terms of what I make, I love underdog stories. I love the idea of writing everyone at the top of their intelligence, which I really honestly think the first Ghostbusters is. Even Peck, the antagonist of the movie, really? Is written as sharp and interesting and is like verbally sparring with Bill Murray, which I think is a lot more engaging to watch than just a heavy.
Yeah. That's something we didn't even touch on, the idea that the villain in the film is from the EPA, which in 1984 would have actually been a hero in any other movie.
I know, right?
And you're right, his objections are all pretty valid.
Oh my god, he's so right!
Yeah.
They have an unlicensed nuclear accelerator. They have all four. Of the four yeah. of them, and they're firing them off in the middle of a densely populated area. None of that makes sense.
It's true.
I also love one of those famous Dan Aykroyd lists. When she's like, you can't come in here without a warrant or a writ or something. And he's like, cease and desist all operation of unlicensed waste handlers, like properties, chattels.
Right.
Like, one of those things you know Dan Aykroyd just listed off the top of his head.
Yeah, he didn't need to research that.
Yeah.
He just knows it.
But yeah, you're totally right. He's absolutely right in every sense of the... Yeah. But except for the ghosts, yes. I think that's a fun inversion of that. But yeah, I love the concept of just... I love when characters are funny and not just making jokes for the audience, but I love when the characters are making jokes for themselves,
right?
Which I think Murray does so beautifully. They all do it in the movie. They're making each other laugh.
Yeah. You get the sense that they really do enjoy each other's company, which is sort of great. Yeah.
Both the actors and the characters. Like, I get why these guys spend time with each other, even though they don't have a ton in common.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing about that movie that I really admire is I love writing probably too much.
Okay.
Like, I love to sit down. I've done a lot of improv in my life. And I wouldn't have done that if it wasn't for seeing this movie and learning about where these guys came from. And then moving to Toronto to start doing classes at Second City and work for them a little bit. And all this kind of stuff. Like, it absolutely was one of the things that got me started on the path that I have ended up on. But, for better or worse. I love knowing all the angles ahead of time, kind of.
Right.
I love sitting down and really crafting a thing and writing it and working with people and being collaborative. And this movie was, as we discussed earlier, so worked on the fly.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, we have a date that we have to deliver a thing. Go. We don't have time to second guess stuff. We don't have time to let the studio meddle a lot. We just kind of have to make it. And I always try to remind myself that sometimes when you just let things happen and let yourself be surprised, you get the things you don't expect.
Right.
And that doesn't have to be bad. Sometimes it's terrible. Sometimes it's self-indulgent. Some people make whole movie comedies where they don't know how to cut improv together.
Yes, we've seen those.
Oh my god, did you see Year One?
Yeah, which is Ramis.
Yes.
Amazingly.
I remember at the time feeling like that was going to be a really great test balloon for what a Ghostbusters 3 would be. Because there was a lot of talk at the time that maybe Ramis would direct it.
Right, and when Jack Black was on and off with it, too. I mean,
he was, yeah.
About it constantly.
And it was the two guys who were exec producers on The Office. It was like Lee Eisenberg and Gene Stupnitsky. I might have transpose their names.
Okay.
But they were working on a Ghostbusters 3 script.
Oh.
Yeah, and they wrote the script for year one. So I was like, oh, this movie will probably give an indication of what a Ghostbusters 3 will look like. Had a great cast, like David Cross, Jack Black.
Yeah, Michael Cera.
Michael Cera, and a few other people in cameos that I'm not remembering. And
it was, yeah, no, it's wall-to-wall.
Yeah, it was brutal. It was unwatchable.
Yeah, there are things about it that I wanted to... I mean, I was pulling for it, and I just don't think it comes together.
It doesn't. You know,
like, from any scene to the next.
And there's a lot of improv that you can tell is in the movie that doesn't cut well together. Like, right. Scenes that just stop, as opposed to ending, and don't have a button, and don't flow. And it just kind of made me realize, like, oh, no. Maybe this thing that I desperately want isn't gonna work. Maybe we can kind of see that coming, but... Yeah, I don't know. I guess I like reminding myself that sometimes when you find stuff as you go, it can be the best stuff.
Yeah.
That I don't often let myself do, unless I make a point of it.
It's good though. I mean, yeah, it's, I want to be open as an audience member the same way. I don't want to go into Ghostbusters, the remake, the sequel, the reboot thinking, well, ladies, what's the point?
Just to
kick that can one more time. I want it to be what it wants to be, and I hope I enjoy it.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, yeah, I don't know. I think that those are four people with a real comedic voice, each individually, that are of this era. The Newman movie's going to feel a lot different, but Ghostbusters felt a lot different from the Bob Hope movies.
That's true.
And
different from almost anything at the time, too, in 1984.
Oh, absolutely. And it's also a movie that I don't think has ever been really that successfully emulated. People have kind of stolen bits of the DNA from it, but I don't think anyone's ever quite nailed whatever the tone of that movie was.
Right.
Which I admire.
Yeah, I'm trying to think as you say that, and that's true. There's no, like, there's a sort of a chaotic element
mm-hmm.
that comes up here and there. But that, even that is, the movie is Reitman riffing on the Blues Brothers or something else where you threw a bunch of stuff at the screen because you're building to chaos. But because of the spine of the Ghostbusters screenplay, it isn't chaotic. It's just
right.
bursting with things. It never feels overstuffed. It feels like it's just creating more ideas and then bubbling over into the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
Absolutely.
Which, God love him. You know, I kind of hope that doesn't come back. I don't want that to be...
Nor do I.
Let him face new things.
I also just love what a batshit crazy concept. A god is coming from another dimension to destroy our universe. We have to choose the form that it's going to take.
Yes, we get to pick.
We get to pick, and what accidentally gets picked is a giant brand mascot. Like yeah. if it was the Michelin Man or Mickey Mouse yeah, or...
It is kind of an amazing... product placement moment,
yeah.
I suppose. Because there are Stave Buck Marshalls earlier in the film just to set it up on Dana's counter.
For sure.
And you don't think twice about it, but mm-hmm. it's in your brain. It's in your subconscious.
I will say, I think that's a little too buried for... Because I had to see that movie a lot of times mm-hmm. before I noticed that detail. Well, there's also a billboard for it behind the firehouse.
But you would have seen it in pan and scan, right? You would have seen the TV version.
You're very correct.
Framed out, things like that. Because it was the 70mm... gorgeous version Panavision print. They're right next to the eggs. You just don't see them in video.
Yeah.
And this brings me to the, you know, all pan and scan must be destroyed. But yeah, scope, like, this is a beautifully shot, messy movie. It uses the frame, like, that laser disc mm-hmm. on your lap is the first widescreen release of the film. And it was the first time, like, it was the joke that Hudson and Ramis said, like, they were finally back in the movie. I mean, the front cover of the Criterion Edition is simply all four characters in a frame.
Oh my god, that's right. Because in the pan and scan, it would have just been the two of them,
yeah,
wouldn't it?
Just to quietly say, no, this is the way you're supposed to see it, and that's not even the whole frame.
I had a VHS of it when I was a kid, and when I was a teenager was the first time I noticed what pan and scan was, and yeah. that I hated it.
Yeah.
Oh, because the pan and scan on this movie was brutal. It was a lot of... like the actual scan.
Yeah, really obvious camera movement because it was 1984 and they didn't care.
Yeah.
It wasn't until years later that they got more sophisticated about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nope. Now anybody who watches it is going to watch it on Blu-ray or Netflix or DVD and you'll see it the way it was meant to be seen.
Mm.
And it is 40% funnier.
Absolutely. And I don't know, I've never seen Ivan Reitman make a movie that looks this good again.
Yeah.
He's a good director. I've never seen him come even close to what this movie is. And I honestly think a lot of that comes from him just being a guy who is sensible enough to get out of a lot of people's way.
Mm.
He realized that on this movie, he was less the auteur and more the traffic cop.
Yeah.
Traffic cop is very reductionist.
But in as much as, yeah, making sure everybody is moving in the same direction and keeping them safe from each other. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way to put it.
Yeah, like he was the collaborator.
Yeah.
And yeah, the movie is so much better for it.
Yeah.
And even Murray just has such a light touch. Like, he showed up on set the day they started filming and was like, what's this thing? Ghostbusters? Great, let's go. And they put him in one of the suits, and they were running down the street, and that was the first thing they shot for, like, the montage.
Oh, yeah.
And, Murray is just in such a zone that he is able to carry whole scenes by himself while not having the fanatical devotion to the concept that Aykroyd does, or the ownership of it that Ramis does.
Yeah. No, it's one of those things where everything came together in exactly the right way and created something that will probably never be repeated, but I hope they find a new way to do it in this new film.
Absolutely.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed, yes.
My thanks to Ian McIntyre, whose name you should look out for in the credits when Degrassi Next Class returns for its second season, July 19th on the Family Channel and July 22nd on Netflix. You can find him on Twitter at Mr. Ian McIntyre. MrIanMacIntyre. You can find Ghostbusters on DVD and Blu-ray from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment, and for rental and purchase on iTunes, Google Play, and pretty much every legitimate streaming service, because it's Ghostbusters. The sequel's out there too, and of course the new movie will be in theaters July 15th. Try not to be a dick about it, okay? As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner, and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, that would be very kind of you. This week's call sign is Mass Hysteria. Thanks for listening.
I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.